You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday, time for our reporter roundtable. This is when we get you updated on the news that made headlines this week around our region. And today, our panel includes Betsy Russell, the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the Eye on Boise blog, Nate Sunderland, Managing Editor of EastIdahoNews.com, and Idaho Statesman opinion writer Brian Clark. Happy Friday, everybody.
Happy Friday.
Hey.
We made it. So, Betsy, I'd like to start with the latest twist in regards to Idaho's new abortion ban law that was set to originally go into effect today.
Right. So that law was put on hold by the Idaho Supreme Court pending a legal challenge that is underway now. And the latest twist was that the legislature has filed to intervene in the case, meaning that the legislature would have its own attorneys offer arguments and submit briefs in addition to those presented on the same side of the case by the Idaho Attorney General defending the law as passed. This actually has happened multiple times before. It is kind of notable that there was another party that wanted to intervene in the case, the Roman Catholic Diocese of Boise, and the court, without comment, rejected that petition to intervene. The court has discretion on which parties it allows to intervene, and it is not uncommon for the court to reject requests to submit amicus briefs, friend of the court briefs, and things like that without ever saying why. But all we know in this case is they said no to the church. They said yes to the legislature.
Okay. And at this point, Betsy, where are we then in this process?
We're in the process of briefs being submitted and arguments being made to the court. We don't even know yet for sure if there will be oral arguments, but all that will be laid out as this moves forward on it. Still a fairly expedited schedule, but not as expedited as they originally anticipated. When the lawsuit was first filed, the plaintiffs asked that it be really expedited and go through very speedily so that it would actually be heard before the law would take effect. The state said that was not sufficient time for it to mount a good defense of the law and asked for more time. And the court gave more time, but also put the law on hold pending this process being gone through. So that's where we are right now.
And so that means, Betsy, that, I mean, this stay will remain in place pending when it goes in front of the court. Is that correct?
That's right. But that is not a decision on the merits of the case. That is a purely procedural move to allow the arguments to be heard.
Okay. Nate, the other big news that once again made national headlines this week, and that is in regards to Lori Vailo Daybell. She was back in court earlier this week. Can you give us an update on what happened?
I'm sure. On Tuesday, Lori appeared in court for the first time since June of last year. And it was a bit of a media circus. We had media from all over the country there again. And it was a very short hearing, only about 15 minutes, but there were some key points that came out of it. The first being that Lori stayed silent throughout the hearing, and her attorney entered or asked the judge to enter a plea of not guilty for her. The second important thing was that she didn't waive her right to a speedy trial. Meaning that legally, the trial's got to occur within 6 months. So the judge has actually set a new trial for Lori for October 11th. The 10-week trial is supposed to end in December, but that's a bit of a problem because Chad, his trial is set for January, and right now both the cases are conjoined. So essentially the judge is going to have to sever the case if they're going to keep these dates. But last month he denied a motion to sever the cases. So we suspect that what's going to happen is that there's going to be some sort of background maneuvering. And I think we'll probably end up with a different court date for Lori than what is currently there. But again, we're just going to have to wait and see on that.
Go ahead, Nate. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say that the final thing to come out of this hearing that was really important was it marked the 60-day notice for prosecutors to decide whether they're going to file the death penalty, or they're going to seek the death penalty in Lori's case. They're already seeking it in Chad's case. But right now they have that 60-day window to decide whether they're going to do it or not.
Mm-hmm. So Nate, what about the idea of where the trial will be held? Because we know that right now it is, set to be held in Ada County, correct? But yes. is it the judge, or who wants to potentially keep it where it is, but have the jury go to Fremont County?
Well, there was another hearing in the morning for Chad, and it was a 3-hour hearing, and it basically focused on that. The defense for Chad and even for Lori both would like the case to be tried completely in Ada County. The prosecution, on the other hand, and especially the local law enforcement, would love for it to be held in Fremont County, mostly because it would cost a great deal less to bring the jurors from Boise and sequester them in Fremont County. It isn't just cost too, it's also manpower. In fact, in Fremont County, the manpower that would be required to go to Boise would severely compromise the sheriff's department, because it's not a very, I mean, Fremont County is, it's not a very, you know, populous county. It's a fairly small sheriff's department, and it would take more than half of their staff to Boise, and that would leave the law enforcement in Fremont County lacking for like 10 weeks. So we're not sure what's going to happen. The judge is going to issue a written ruling on whether they're going to hold it in Ada County or whether they're going to bring over the jury and sequester them. But there's certainly a big push among law enforcement and the prosecution to at least keep part of it here.
Hmm. Okay, so we'll have to wait on that. And yeah. Before we move on, one of the children who passed away, JJ, this was Lori's 7-year-old son. I believe he was 7. His grandparents held a news conference after the court hearings this week, Chad. I mean, Nate, sorry.
It's okay. Yeah, they did. And, you know, it was a very heartfelt news conference. Kay broke down during it. The grandparents are happy to see the process moving forward. They're praying for justice to be served, and they just want justice for the 4 innocent people that were killed. And they're very happy that the process is moving forward and that they're able to come here and actually look Chad and Lori in the face.
Okay. So at this point, then what's next in this process? I guess finding out where the trial will actually be held.
Yes. That's what we're going to find. The next pieces of news that are going to come out of this are whether they're going to seek the death penalty for Lori, and where the case, where it's going to be tried.
Okay. Brian, will you update us on what's going on in Caldwell in regards to the police department and an FBI investigation? And maybe for folks who haven't been following this, give us some background on this.
Sure thing. So the latest news this week is that 6 current and former Caldwell police officers and 1 Meridian officer have been sued by Treasure Valley residents, alleging excessive force and other violations of rights. This comes on the heels of the resignation of the Caldwell police chief late last month, amid news that there were several police officers under investigation by the FBI. These investigations reportedly relate to Caldwell's street crimes unit. That's a little bit notable because a lot of major police corruption scandals around the country going back decades have focused on special units like these. Maybe the most famous was in the 1990s, the crash anti-gang unit in LAPD. That In that case, ultimately, 70 officers were accused and 24 were disciplined. So still not a lot known about this case, but developments are coming out by the day.
Mm-hmm. And it is something where, I mean, Brian, when this did come out, I think it was fairly shocking for the entire community, it seems like. And as you mentioned, though, not much is known about why the FBI is involved, but that never looks good.
Yeah, that's right. And it's very rare to get a lot of information about these. The FBI is extremely tight-lipped. So is the U.S. Attorney's Office. I've covered police scandals in other places that involved FBI investigations. The only way you ever really find out anything specific is if some of the victims decide to come forward. But there's still not a lot that's known about the subjects of these investigations right now.
Well, the primary election, it is quickly approaching. Normally, that means this time of year we have a lot of candidate debates to keep track of. That is not the case this year. Betsy, what in the world is going on?
Well, we still do have candidate debates to keep track of, but some of them were canceled this year. And the reason for that is that we had four high-profile top Republican candidates who declined to debate their opponents in the primary election this year. And that ended up prompting three debates to be canceled that were part of the Idaho debates, a long-standing collaboration between the Idaho Press Club, Idaho Public Television, the League of Women Voters of Idaho, and Idaho's public universities, in which debates are broadcast live across the state on Idaho Public Television. So as a result of that, Governor Brad Little declined to debate his primary election challengers, and then Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan declined to debate the challengers who were still on, which at that point was Ed Humphreys, and so the governor's debate was canceled. In the lieutenant governor's race, Priscilla Giddings, state representatives, declined to debate her opponent in the race for lieutenant governor. So that debate was canceled. And then in the second congressional district debate, Congressman Mike Simpson declined to debate his primary challenger, Brian Smith. So that debate was canceled. And the reason for that is you can't have a debate with just one candidate.
Right.
That would not be a debate. but there are still three that are scheduled. In fact, one has already occurred on Tuesday night. The three candidates in the Republican primary for Idaho Attorney General faced off in a very lively debate that was broadcast statewide and is available for viewing online right now at idahoptv.org/idahodebates. It was a good one, and there are more coming up. On Monday, the three Republican candidates for state superintendent of public instruction are going to debate in the Idaho debates. And on Tuesday, April 26th, the three Republican candidates for Idaho secretary of state are going to debate on the Idaho debates. And there are other debates and forums around the state as well. And they are a good opportunity for voters to see the candidates in action, hear what they have to say, and make their decisions in advance of our May 17th primary election.
So, Betsy, I found it interesting that Governor Little said that he would not participate, basically saying, I think his quote was, his record is non-debatable. And that's debatable, actually.
It certainly is. That particular comment struck me kind of strange, because it's not a very American concept. In our system, an incumbent's record is always debatable. And they always have to make the case to the voters as to whether they should get another term or someone who's running against them perhaps might be a better choice for a particular voter. And that's how our system works. Similarly, Congressman Mike Simpson said that he thought that the voters didn't need to hear any more from his opponent. Well, generally, in our system, that's not a decision for the incumbent to make. That's a decision for the voters to make. So it was disappointing to me, because I think that kind of exposure of a candidate, especially an incumbent, and how their views contrast with those of their challengers is something that's really important information to get out to voters. And as a reporter, it's my job to get information out to people. Mm-hmm. That's what we want to do. That's why I am involved with the Idaho debates as a volunteer. I'm the president of the Idaho Press Club, and that's my involvement with the Idaho debates. And we supply the reporters for the panels. It is a very worthwhile endeavor, so much so that Governor Little has now become the first sitting governor seeking re-election in more than three decades to decline to participate in the Idaho debates.
It's very disappointing because ultimately, it does not allow the voter to have all of the information. And I think you make a very good point, Betsy, when you say, you know, it's not up for whether you are the incumbent or whether you are a challenger to make that decision. But yet they have.
That's correct.
And we talked a little bit more. Oh, go ahead,
I was just going to say we've seen some of the same positioning at the national level with the RNC pulling out of the national presidential debates. So I think it's an unfortunate trend that we're seeing right now. And it's probably
Let's talk a little bit about that debate. Was it Monday, Tuesday night for Attorney General? Because we have the sitting Attorney General Lawrence Wasdin, and then Raul Labrador and Art Maycumber, as you said. And one of the things that struck me in this debate, Betsy, was something that Raul Labrador said, and that is that he said the job is not just a legal job; it's a political job. And I think of this position, and maybe I'm wrong. As the Attorney General, you are almost supposed to be that checks and balances. I mean, you are supposed to look at the law, and then therefore proceed with what the Constitution says, whether that's the Idaho Constitution or the U.S. Constitution. So when you put this political spin on it, how was that taken during the debates?
I think that this is exactly the kind of thing that a debate can bring out for the voters. So what we saw in that debate was a really different concept of what the role of the Idaho Attorney General should be, articulated by the three different candidates. And Attorney General Wasdin made it very clear that he believes the role of the Attorney General is what is delineated in the Idaho Constitution and in Idaho state law. And the other two candidates had different priorities. Raul Labrador talked about his political experience and taking a political stand and being more aggressive and sending a message and standing with conservative legislators. Art Maycumber talked about challenging longstanding ways of doing things and even advocated for some things that Attorney General Wasdin jumped right in and said, nope, you can't do that. The Constitution or the law in code section, blah, 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 says you can't. It was an interesting debate that clearly was among three attorneys, but it also was of interest, I think, just to lay people. It's worth watching, especially if you haven't made up your mind which of those three you want to vote for, if you're a voter in the Republican primary, or if you want to get a sense of where these candidates stand and how they view the role of this very important office, which is, in fact, enshrined in the Idaho Constitution.
Mm-hmm. So, Betsy, what are the other debates that are set to come up? Because as we mentioned, I mean, the primary election is right around the corner.
Right. Well, on Monday, we've got the three candidates for superintendent of public instruction, and those are the incumbent, Sherry Ibarra, who is seeking a third term, and two challengers, Debbie Critchfield, who until quite recently was the president of the State Board of Education, and Brandon Durst, a former Democratic state senator who is now running as a right-wing conservative Republican and has been very combative in his approach to this race. And that should be a very interesting face-off as well. That's coming up on Monday at 8 p.m.
Okay. Brian, you are working on a story in regards to a shift in legislative seats over in eastern Idaho. Can you talk a bit more about this? Because this could have an impact on redistricting, potentially?
Well, it's more that redistricting could have an impact on the makeup of eastern Idaho. Mm. And the political dynamics statewide. So I've been covering eastern Idaho for about 7-8 years now. And when I first got here, this was considered a very moderate area of the state. It was heavily Republican controlled, but quite moderate. Brent Hill was from here, Bart Davis. In the years that have followed, about depending on how you count, 8 or 10 of the 14 seats in this area have shifted dramatically to the right. Some of that even involves people who haven't lost an election, but have simply shifted to the right on their own. It's really changed statewide political dynamics. If you think about some of the most controversial bills that have come up in recent years, the CRT bill, the transgender sports bill, attempts at nullification laws, a lot of these bills have been sponsored by Eastern Idaho legislators. Now, what's interesting this year is that because of redistricting, everybody's running in a new district, and there's a real push by the more moderate faction of the GOP to take back some ground. So I think this will be an interesting area of the state to watch this May.
Nate, can you talk to us about an update to a story? This is over in Eastern Idaho again. There is a grocery store employee who hid cameras in bathrooms for 2 years? Can you tell us about this and what's going on?
Yeah, it's a fairly disturbing story. There was a guy last month who was arrested. His name is Roberto Bravo Camacho. And he was a grocery store employee, and he allegedly hid several cameras in vents of bathrooms, and he did it over a 2-year period. And we found out this week that the police have found thousands of videos of minors and adults that are sexually explicit. And at this point, the sheriff's office has identified almost 100 victims, and they're thinking that there could be quite a few more. And that's pretty shocking for the Driggs area. I mean, it's just a little community in Eastern Idaho, and to have and it's a heavily trafficked area. There's a lot of people that go through there to get to Jackson Hole. Mm-hmm. And so there's potentially a lot of victims. And so the sheriff's office there is asking that if anyone used the bathrooms at the Brolums and Driggs to contact them within the last 2 years, because you may be a victim. And that just sounds horrible.
Well, and Nate, you know, for folks who may not be familiar with Driggs, as you mentioned, I mean, it is a small town. And so if they have already said that there's 100 victims, everyone knows someone in that community, yeah, then who is a exactly potential victim, right? And then, as you said, that's how you get, if you're driving, that's how you get to Jackson Hole. So this, I mean, in a 2-year period, I mean, this could be thousands of people, I would think.
Absolutely. This case will shake their community.
Yeah,
for sure.
All right. So where are we right now with the legal proceedings?
You know, his next hearing is on May 17th. He is out of jail. He posted a $10,000 bond. So we're just going to wait for that next hearing. He's charged with 3 felony counts of video voyeurism and one charge of attempting to destroy the evidence.
Okay. Betsy, as we know here in Idaho, in a lot of ways, we really are a one-party state. Yet the Republican primaries are closed to only registered Republicans. So if you want your voice heard, I mean, you actually have to go and change your party affiliation. So what do we know in regards to people actually going and taking these steps and meeting deadlines to do this so that they can vote in the primary election? Because that's really where a lot of things will be decided, frankly.
Well, I think this is a really interesting question. And of course, what we don't know is how many people have already done that and had done that before this year. But I decided to take a look at how much the numbers had changed from January 1 to the most recent report, which was April 1. Because as of January 1, we still had 310,000 voters in Idaho who are registered as unaffiliated with any party. And with all the talk about people switching, and particularly people wanting to switch ahead of the legislature changing any laws about when you could switch from unaffiliated, which ended up not happening, but there was a sense that there was some urgency there. There was a lot of speculation about a big rush of unaffiliated voters switching to Republican, maybe even Democratic voters switching to Republican. And so when I looked at the numbers from January 1 to April 1, surprisingly, the change was not that great at all. The number of unaffiliated voters dropped from 310,000 on January 1 to 303,396 on April 1. And that was a drop of about 6,800. That is only a 2% decline in the total number of unaffiliated Idaho registered voters. At the same time, the number of Republican registered voters did go up, but it didn't go up by that much either. And we know that many of those moving here appear to be Republicans, so that may also have bolstered those Republican numbers. And I did speak with Jeffrey Lyons, a political scientist at Boise State University, who said that there's a bunch of research out there that tells us anytime you make people do any level of paperwork, it is a big turnoff, quote. That's from the professor. And it's just something a lot of people aren't going to do. And so he believes that the switching of parties in order to be able to get into a closed primary is not something that's nearly as widespread as people on both the left and the right think it is.
Well, and Betsy, whatever happened to maybe you mentioned this, there was a bill in the legislature earlier this year in regards to unaffiliated voters. And that they, because in the past you could choose which ballot you wanted if you were unaffiliated. Where are we with that?
Right. So that bill, House Bill 439, was very controversial. It passed the House fairly early in the session, and then its fate was undetermined for a very long period of time, but it ended up never passing the Senate. It did not become law. So while there remained a March 11th deadline for anyone who's affiliated with one party to switch to be affiliated with a different party before the primary, and that didn't change, that rule doesn't apply to unaffiliated voters. So if there are unaffiliated voters out there who, when they arrive at the polls, think, no, I don't want to be unaffiliated anymore, I want to affiliate with a party and vote in their primary, they can still do so at the polls on election day.
And that is something I know, Betsy, you've been on Idaho Matters and we've discussed in the past, is that even though we may be considered a more of a one-party state, I mean, a majority of our registered voters in Idaho are unaffiliated. And that kind of goes back to that independent spirit that a lot of people who live in Idaho really hold on to.
Well, we have actually crept up now to where a majority of our registered voters, just a bit over 50%, maybe up to 55%, are now registered Republicans. But there are a whole lot, still around a third, who are unaffiliated. And there are others, you know, smaller numbers who are affiliated with the Democratic Party, the Constitution Party, the Libertarian Party. And, you know, going back a decade and a half, we didn't used to have to register by party in Idaho until the Idaho Republican Party actually filed a federal lawsuit and said that they wanted to have a closed primary and exclude everybody else. And so they have opted to do that. Idaho law, since they won that lawsuit, does permit that now. And in fact, any party's primary is now assumed to be closed to anyone except their registered party members, unless they file with the Secretary of State to have it be open. Now, the Idaho Democratic Party has done that. So the Democratic primary is open, and you don't have to be a registered Democrat to vote in it. But all the other ones, the Republicans and any contested races in Libertarian or Constitution Party, are closed. Only registered party members may vote in those primaries, unless they're unaffiliated. But then they've got to become a registered party member at the polls, which is what happens if you affiliate at the polls.
Just want to make it as hard as possible. So also a thing that we will see on the ballot are initiatives. We see this sometimes. Brian, can you talk to us about this push that was going on to get a citizen initiative on the ballot to legalize marijuana in Idaho? What's the latest with that?
Well, the latest on the marijuana initiative is that it won't make the ballot, and it didn't come close. This has been an ongoing effort that's been standing for several years, but it's never had the kind of organizational sophistication as efforts led by Reclaim Idaho and others that have had some success getting on the ballot. In this case, only about 7,000 of the required 70,000 signatures gathered that were required were actually gathered. And that's 70,000 that actually qualify. You always have a bunch that are struck. So more realistically, you would maybe need 90 or 90,000 or more. So this really didn't come anywhere close to getting on the ballot.
But Joe, a different initiative, this time regarding education, looks like it may make it to the November ballot. And this is coming from Reclaim Idaho. So talk to us about this.
Yes, there's actually a pretty good chance that the Quality Education Act initiative will make the ballot in Idaho. You need 65,000 valid signatures, as well as 6% in 18 legislative districts. The 18 legislative districts Reclaim Idaho has accomplished, when I spoke with their leadership yesterday, including Luke Mayville, they say, you know, they've got about 90,000 signatures. And so you say, oh, well, you have 30,000 more, then they should be good. Just of note here, when you have any of these initiative or petition campaigns, a good amount of the signatures that volunteers gather will actually get thrown out for one reason or another. Either they're illegible, or somebody signed the petition that wasn't supposed to, or somebody, you know, out of state signed it. So just, you know, that's always good to remember. But yes, this Quality Education Act, long story short, it would look to raise taxes for people that are making $250,000 annually or more, or $500,000 with a combined household. And every dollar over $250,000 a year would be taxed at 10.925%. The other thing that the Quality Education Act looks to do is increase the state's corporate tax rate. 6% right now would move it up to 8%. So with those changes in the tax formulas, the proposal is to create revenue to the tune of about $300 million to plug into Idaho education, to pay teachers, to pay support staff. The people from Reclaim Idaho, the supporters from Reclaim Idaho, say that they do appreciate that the legislature has given some more money to, you know, public education in Idaho in recent years, but they're of the opinion that it's not enough and that there needs to be more sent to the system. Of course, there's a lot of talk in their campaign about this 2021 statistic from the National Education Alliance that Idaho is last in per pupil funding and per student funding in the nation. So that's really what they point to and saying we need to create some more funds to get the, you know, education rolling here in Idaho, is their opinion. So if this qualifies for the ballot, it would be on this November general election ballot, and it looks like it likely will qualify. Idaho voters would get to decide yes or no. Should we increase the tax rate on some of the highest earners in our state? And should we increase the tax rate for the corporate tax in order to pay for this? It'll be interesting to see how this shakes out. When I talk to volunteers that have been going door to door for Reclaim Idaho, they say they've had some pretty interesting conversations that they kind of had on their Medicaid door to door campaign, where people on both sides of the aisle, or all sides of the aisle, I should say, wanted to have a conversation and agreed that, you know, if you don't want to talk about content, that's fine. But we did agree that, you know, we wanted to see more money going towards Idaho education. It'll be interesting, though, Gemma, how that shakes out if it does make the ballot. And again, it should, and see if Idahoans would support raising taxes to pay for education.
I think it's worth pointing out that there are multiple sources for that statistic about Idaho being last in per student funding for education. And we have, in fact, been last or near last for quite a number of years now. When I wrote about this issue this week, I checked the census figures from 2019. Idaho, absolutely dead last. And the idea of this initiative is that the funds that would be raised would be put into a dedicated fund that would be sent out on a per student basis, specifically to raise our per student funding from dead last in the basement. And the organizers expect it to raise us at least two or three ranks so that we wouldn't be last. We might still be in the bottom 10, but we wouldn't be last anymore. And that's been a big part of the debate. Our per student funding level is definitely last. It's less than, it's roughly 60% of the national average. It is low, despite all the gains that we have made. Other states have made gains as well.
Yeah, and Betsy makes a great point. That 2021 number I mentioned, that's only one statistic that volunteers will point to. But whether you support this initiative or not, as Betsy just highlighted, the facts are there. And there are multiple metrics, right, and there are multiple statistics that you could point to that say, yeah, Idaho is, if not last, at the very bottom of all of these metrics and funding.
What about corporations? Are they saying anything? Are they keeping quiet right now? Because pretty significant tax implications for them.
Yeah, and we have heard from those in the business community that have, you know, raised some pretty general concerns, saying, you know, if you raise the corporate tax rate in Idaho, there may be businesses that say, well, maybe we don't want to go do business there. Maybe that we don't want to, you know, end up having a situation where we'd have to pay too much in taxes that we've already budgeted for 6%. So, I mean, there is concern. It's general concern right now. I haven't heard from any major corporations that say, oh, we're not going to go to Idaho if this passes, or we're going to leave Idaho if this passes. But I mean, 2% is 2%. And if you're a major corporation and you're looking for a low tax rate, if it's increased in Idaho, maybe you look otherwhere. At the end of the day, though, to some companies, it may not matter.
It's also probably worth noting that most Idaho businesses, most Idaho small businesses, don't pay that corporate tax rate. They pay the individual tax rate because they're organized as sole proprietorships, partnerships, or LLCs. So the majority of the corporate tax rate impact will be on the largest, the multinational corporations. That's part of the reason why the corporate income tax in Idaho is actually not a huge source of funding for the state. It brings in only about 7% of our general fund revenues. The individual income tax brings in 49%.
All right. Betsy, tuition at Idaho State Universities will be frozen again. However, students could be paying more, correct?
That's right. While tuition will be frozen at all the universities next year, some fees will go up. And in most cases, those fee increases are quite small. The one exception really is Boise State University, where it could be as much as $300. But those fees are tied directly to increased costs for the specific items that those fees fund. Everything from increases in student mental health services to increase in electrical bills at Idaho State University. And the university's presidents did stick to their promise to freeze tuition. So tuition will remain frozen.
Okay.
And Joe, I should add that the State Board of Education also has a new policy that allows students for the first time to opt out of some of the fees. And so the fees have been divided into various categories. Some are mandatory, some are optional. All of those that support student clubs, activities, and other things on campus are now optional. And students have the option to not pay those. That, of course, means then they're not supporting those activities.
Mm-hmm. But they have a choice in that. Joe, KTVB recently did a story on Powerball, because Powerball is celebrating 30 years. And you talked with Idaho's largest Powerball winner. Talk to us a little bit about this, because I tell you, too, I can't believe I'm just getting old, because it feels like this just happened recently, but it's been quite a while since he won.
Yeah. If you're new to the area, Brad Duke, he won millions and millions of dollars back in 2005. And the funny note about this story is that the jackpot that the Powerball jackpot that Brad Duke won, it's actually the same gas station that Pam Hyatt had won a Powerball jackpot prize at about a decade before. And it's the only store in North America that has sold two tickets for a Powerball jackpot winner. So we got an opportunity to sit down with Brad Duke. A lot of people remember him from the news cycle back in the early 2000s. He won $220 million, and he ended up taking a lump sum. So he got well over $100 million in terms of the actual payout. Wow. And he had a goal of, you know, going and turning that into $1 billion. We talked to him. He said he hasn't turned it into $1 billion yet, but he said it's still one of his top three goals. But it's always interesting to me when, you know, I mean, I'm sure everyone listening has at least once fantasized about winning the lottery. What would you do with millions of dollars? So it's interesting to sit down with someone and just ask, you know, what was that experience like? How do you reflect on, you know, winning this unbelievable amount of money? Does it even still feel real? For him, though, he says, you know, the reality eventually sits in, and he's done a lot of work with the Duke Family Foundation, and he's done some really cool pet projects as well. Like he was a track star in high school, and he had to run on a pretty rundown track at Salmon River High School. So he's actually been able to two separate times fund special projects to make sure that the athletes at Salmon River High School have awesome facilities to run at and train at and do all kinds of awesome track activities at. But just a fun little story we got to do with Brad Duke celebrating 30 years of Powerball. Mm-hmm. I've bought plenty of tickets over the years, Gemma. I've never personally won, so it was cool to sit down and talk to someone who did win hundreds of millions of dollars. And the thing that I'll never get over He was working at Gold's Gym when he won this.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, at the Gold's Gym on Park Center. Yeah, in Boise.
I have to ask, where is this Lucky Gas station?
Okay,
isn't it the Stinker?
Yes, so
it's the Stinker station on Boise Avenue, isn't it? Or on Apple?
Yeah, off Orchard, right by not too far from the airport. So if you're driving out towards, like, if you're on your way out of town, headed off like I-84 East, if you were to get off on that Orchard exit, it would be that Stinker station there, right on the corner.
Just
oh yeah,
seems like
yeah,
something right good to know.
You know what? That place is going to be busy today.
Yeah, if you're feeling lucky, get a ticket on the way home.
Yeah, well, here's what I do remember about Brad when he won back in 2005 was it took him a while to come forward publicly because he was very strategic when he won. I mean, he got a legal team in place. He really made a solid plan. And I think, Joe, I mean, we've seen this. I mean, you see this across the board, right? Where the majority of people who win these large jackpots, they either run through their money. I mean, they end up, you know, running through the money. And that's not the case with him. I mean, he really goes against the grain with that. Before we go, I do want to wrap up with a viral video. Nate, can you talk to us about this? Because it's pretty funny and adorable.
It really is. Essentially, there's this family in eastern Idaho that got a pregnant cow. And they found out that the pregnant cow was next to a herd of yaks and that the father was a yak. And so when the calf was born, they found out that it was a cow-yak hybrid. They decided to take to social media and document the little guy's life. Apparently, he's very, very rambunctious. They call him, he's turbocharged, a speedy little hamburger patty. Anyway, most of the videos didn't do very well until they created one that called, they nicknamed him the Farm Terrorist. And it went viral on TikTok and it's now got 4.4 million views, which is pretty cool.
Well, here's the thing. I never even knew that there could be a yak cow hybrid. So we learned something new today.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we will, it really is worth seeing. It's super cute, super funny out of East Idaho. I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy schedules to come on the roundtable. Always appreciate it. So big thanks to our reporter roundtable today, Betsy Russell, who is the Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press, as well as the voice of the Eye on Boise blog. Nate Sunderland, Managing Editor of EastIdahoNews.com, and Joe Parrish, reporter with KTVB Television. And a thank you again to Idaho Statesman Opinion Reporter Brian Clark, who was on the program earlier today. And I want to thank all of you on this Friday for joining us. Always appreciate you as well. Our senior producer is Samantha Wright. Our assistant producer is Hannah Gardowski. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. And our executive producers, Paul Stribling and Tom Michael. Do you have a question for us? Maybe a comment? Maybe an idea for the show? We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. And hey, the sun is shining. Get out there and enjoy it. Have a good weekend. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you back here Monday.